Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast. Friday, the 29th of March. Good Friday, if you will. Happy Good Friday to you, David. Or good Friday. I don't know. What's the official greeting?
Don't know. I think Happy Good Friday maybe is it. I've never said it before, so it doesn't quite sound right. But yes, here we are on the eve of Easter and a few days off. The wind continues to blow in Solihull and the rain continues to lash down. So welcome to spring, everybody.
Yes, it's just frankly not spring, is it? Certainly not as advertised. Easter's a weird, I mean, happy Easter to all those that celebrate. But Easter is my least favourite of the holidays that I'm sort of forced into vaguely recognising because everything's closed. If you're not a Christian and you also don't work normal office hours and get to enjoy having two bank holidays, and I realise that is a great privilege, and for everyone listening thinking, I don't go to church but I do blooming love a bank holiday, lovely, enjoy that, good luck to you. But if you aren't either of those things, I do just find it sort of vaguely inconvenient that there's a couple of days where public transport isn't running properly and nothing's open. Happy Easter, Matt.
If you're a podcaster.
Right, yeah, if you haven't got a proper job.
Yeah, I'm just about to test out said public transport not working very well. So give it 2 hours and I might be right there with you, Catherine, cursing Easter.
I'm enjoying my kids' chocolate.
Thoughts and prayers for that. Yeah, I suppose I was going to say, and you don't get the razzle dazzle of Christmas, but I suppose you do get chocolate. But I'm not that into chocolate.
I mean,
that's
weird.
I'm not sure that's something I've ever confessed before publicly, but there it is. I've said it. Anyway, I wasn't intending to start the show with an Easter rant. Look, it's fine. It's absolutely fine.
She's not stopped.
Yeah. Last week we had extended Masters 1000 events. Bad. This week Easter. Fine.
It's just a bit inconvenient, isn't it? Anyway, right, we have tennis to talk about. Before we do that, let's talk about On Location, the premium
hospitality and experience provider.
As you probably know, On Location are sponsoring us throughout the Sunshine Double, or Double Sunshine, in the words of Carlos Alcaraz, who will not be doing the Double Sunshine in 2024. On Location has incredible travel and VIP ticket packages available for all of the sport's biggest event. That means Madrid, Roland Garros, the US Open and Wimbledon. Could you say that in announcer voice, please, Matt? At Wimbledon.
At Wimbledon.
Oh, I've missed that. I can't wait for the return of at Wimbledon. Courtesy of On Location and Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours, you can take your pick of amazing debenture packages, which include brilliant centre court and number one court tickets, a dedicated entry point into the grounds of the All England Club, exclusive access to debenture areas, and they are sexy. Folks, those debenture areas. And you'll also stay at the five-star JW Marriott Grosvenor House, yep. Hotel. Grosvenor. No, it's a silent S. The JW Marriott Grosvenor House Hotel, however you pronounce it, it's fancy. And if that's not enough, there's also the additional option of going on a luxury seven-day cruise to Croatia, which... honestly, and I know David has skin in the game here, but I've been on a holiday to Croatia and it is one of the most beautiful countries in the world. I think it's the clearest waters I've ever seen.
Where did you go? I've never heard that before.
I went to Pula.
Oh, it's lovely. Yes, it's all lovely.
Many, many years ago with a dreadful ex-boyfriend. Anyway. The location was wonderful. Just go to tours.
That might be
tours.
Why you haven't heard about the trip before, yeah. David.
I think that might be it.
Tours
well,
for
now,
tennis.
Now we all have.
toursfortennis.com/Wimbledon. Tours, the number four, tennis.com/Wimbledon. To choose your package to Wimbledon and maybe also Croatia, just choose who you go with very carefully, which takes place between the 1st and the 14th of July. And if you're a friend of the Tennis Podcast, we can offer you a 5% discount on your Wimbledon package and all of On Location's other travel and VIP ticket offerings apart from the Olympic Games. So if you're a friend, just contact us at friends@tennispodcast.net for the discount. Now, Miami, lots happened since Monday when we were last with you. Somehow the women's final is already set. It's got a very different cadence, Miami, to Indian Wells. And whereas in this stage of Indian Wells, I think we'd only had the quarterfinals played, certainly of the, yeah, I think on both sides. Anyway, we have reached the final stage of the women's. It will be Elena Rybakina against Danielle Collins, which is quite a juicy final. I think. I mean, I'm really, really looking forward to it. Rybakina reached the final last night by beating Victoria Azarenka 6-4, Love 6, 7-6 in a totally and utterly wild semi-final. I think we all watched this, didn't we? I mean, I was kind of, I actually went to do a bit of yoga in the middle of it because after the first set, Victoria Azarenka goes off for a bathroom break after the first set when she'd played really well, competed really well, but it just looked to me like these are quite similar game styles. Rybakina is playing well. She's a better player than Azarenka when she's playing well. This match doesn't have many legs in it. I'm going to take the opportunity to do a little bit of yoga before Alcaraz against Dimitrov. Oh, how misjudged a decision that was. Don't worry, I did bail out of the yoga to give this match my full attention. But it had a little bit of everything, didn't it, David?
It did, and yet it wasn't really a good spectacle until the final set, I didn't think, because I mean the first set was interesting, and I think as you said, it to me it was kind of like the same player 10 years apart. Rybakina is almost like the new model of the same player, just updated, a few extra kind of frills in terms of ability to hit the ball even harder and cleaner and more devastatingly, and therefore she won the first set. And then a combination of Azarenka just rebooting and playing out of her mind and Rybakina falling apart led to a second set in which in 29 points Rybakina won 5. I mean, that is an astonishingly small number of points to win in a set of tennis for anybody, let alone a Wimbledon champion, one of the three or four best players in the world. And she lost 16 points in a row at one point. At the same time, she did an excellent job of rebooting in The Decider, and you therefore had two or three comebacks going on. You had Azarenka coming back from a set down. You had Rybakina coming back from losing a 6-love set, and then you had Azarenka coming back from a deficit in the third set and making it into an absolutely barnstorming finish. It was brilliant. It was Azarenka rolling back the years. It was Azarenka in real Street Fighter mode, and yet you got Rybakina when she was on, reminding you what a clean ball striker is and what an absolutely wonderful sound it makes when she hits the ball properly. And it ended up with a final set tiebreak. It was all over the place, and I had no clue where it was going to end up. And I didn't really mind who won. It was one of those. I usually have a kind of... I suppose I wanted Azarenka to win because I said she'd win the tournament in the newsletter this week. And so, you know... That's all going up in smoke. But anyway, I really enjoyed the match.
Yeah, well, when it went to that deciding set tiebreak, I went and got snacks, Matt, because I thought, well, it's Rybakina in a deciding set tiebreak. We all know how this goes. This is not my first rodeo. But actually, she found a gear in that tiebreak, didn't she?
And what I thought was really impressive is she served for the match at 5-4. Azarenka was upping her intensity. She was coming at her. She broke. But then Rybakina didn't lose another point on serve in the match. You know, she held to love to get it into a tie break, and then she was flawless behind her serve in the tie break. And I thought that was a really impressive reset after failing to serve it out at the first attempt. And honestly, I am finding Rybakina fascinating this year. I don't really understand her, but I think she has played three of the most memorable matches of the year already. I mean, the match where she utterly crushed Sabalenka in Brisbane is living rent-free in my head ever since, because how does that person then not go on to win the Australian Open in that form? She was staggeringly good. Of course, the blink of a match at the Australian Open, who can forget the tie break? And then honestly, this one with the momentum changes that David was describing, I think will sort of really stand out to me when I look back on this season. And yet I feel like with Rybakina's game, she should be playing more efficient matches. You know, she's got a serve that when she gets that first serve in, it's regularly not coming back. Or if it is coming back, it's putting her in a position to win the point. And she's got a return that can dominate opponents. And yet, all tournament and kind of all year, she's playing these epics, these classics. She's had 6-4 in the third three times in Miami. She had a 7-6 in the third. And there just seems to be these real ups and downs, peaks and troughs in her game at the moment. None more extreme than that second set collapse yesterday against Azarenka. But yeah, she's kind of fascinating, and I'm incredibly impressed that she's winning all these matches. I think it's a big deal because she came into Miami off the back of being unwell and unable to play in Indian Wells. I had genuine concerns about whether she would be able to last the cause in Miami, but she's actually done so and come through real tough matches. So I think that's a good sign. But there is part of me that thinks she's still kind of nowhere near her best, because at her best, I think she would be winning these matches a lot more efficiently. And, you know, it's credit to her opponents for pushing her. Sakkari really pushed her, Azarenka yesterday as well. You know, that they've played really well. And, you know, I'm probably underestimating them in thinking that Rybakina can just sweep them aside. But that is the image I have of Rybakina in my head because of that Brisbane final. I know how good she can be when she's at her best. And, yeah, she's become like a must-see watch at the moment because her matches are really, really compelling.
Yeah, with her game, she should be totally boring, shouldn't she? She should be just sort of, you know, three-shot rallies most of the time, generally sweeping people aside until she comes up against a Świątek or a Sabalenka. But as you say, her matches are, they're unmissable at the moment. She said, shortly after winning the match last night on Sky, she said, "I am not 100% physically. I'm quite far from it." She's really proud of how she's winning these grueling matches in spite of that. But it is very much in spite of that. And it does feel like it's going to catch up with her eventually. And she's coming up in the final against a player who hasn't dropped a set this tournament, who is right in the zone in Danielle Collins.
Yeah, and she described, didn't she, Rybakina, the second set loss yesterday, 6-love, as her energy going down. She said she found it tough with the conditions and the humidity, hard to regroup. Suddenly she was 3-love down and it all just sort of ran away from her. That, like, as you say, there is a real lasting effect, I think, of everything that she's sort of suffered health-wise in the last year or so. She's not quite physically at her best, so it is impressive that she's managing to regroup and come through these matches.
Yeah, with the sort of consistent these consistent flare-ups of illnesses, she's pulled out of a number of tournaments over the last year with suffering from viral illnesses is the reason cited. There is a lot of speculation going around that perhaps she's suffering from long COVID. She hasn't used those words. I'm not going to diagnose her with something that I don't have the medical information to do so. But it certainly is a possibility, isn't it? And if that is the case, or any kind of sort of lingering post-viral situation, it would certainly explain a lot. But I don't know. What do you think about this final, David?
I think this is a cracking final on paper, and I must say, I'd love to see Danielle Collins against Azarenka as well, just because of the personalities they both are, the way they go about their business. So I'm a little bit disappointed not to get that in a way, two street fighters. But at the same time, Rybakina against either one of them is a great contest, is a great contrast of approaches and personalities, really. And Collins, her route to this final is astonishing. I mean, you know, these are good players. She's just been dusting, really, losing five games a match, pretty much. You know, Sorana Castella and loads of really good players that she's been just knocking over with barely a thought, really. And she came up against Alexandrova, who's had this fantastic run to this final, including beating Iga Świątek comfortably in the previous rounds. And early on, I'd almost forgotten how dominant Collins had been to get to this point. She beat Garcia in the semifinals as well. Garcia had been getting all these great wins against Osaka earlier in the tournament and Coco Gauff. But then suddenly you saw why Collins has had all these comfortable wins. I mean, I dare say Alexandrova would say she wasn't at her best as well. And I think she made a terrible error by just feeding the backhand on serve constantly. She kept kicking out these serves to the backhand of Collins. And it's almost like waving a white flag in a rally against that backhand, because it's not only the quality of the ball strike. And I'd be very curious to hear what you think of her backhand generally, Matt, because to me, It is a combination of reliable, the Collins backhand, and just furious, ferocious. She is just trying to take your head off with that shot. And it almost invariably goes back cross court. And it's just you are going to get this backhand right now because you've put it in the slot to me. And really, she ran away with the match from there on. And there is it's probably a little bit too easy to draw a cause and effect between her decision to end her career at the end of this year and the freedom that, in my mind, that must give her. But, you know, she gave an interview with Matt Futterman in The Athletic and seems so at ease with her decision at this point. No suggestion that she wants to change her mind. And I do wonder whether it is that. I wonder whether that helps. Just think, I don't have to do this anymore after the end of this year. So I'm going to go for it.
How can it not help, whether it's a conscious thought or not? Just imagine if you will, sorry to continue talking about yoga, but, you know, you're in a plank and you're thinking, I simply can't do this any longer. And then the instructor starts a countdown from 10. Suddenly you get a second win, just long enough to carry you through to the number zero, right? And I don't think that's too much of a stretch of an analogy, because as Danielle Collins reminded us in one of her press conferences this week, she is suffering from and is managing day to day a pretty debilitating physical illness. She suffers from endometriosis. She also suffers from rheumatoid arthritis, doesn't she? But in this instance, she was referring to the endometriosis, which, although she's subsequent to getting a full diagnosis, she's found the right medication for, it's still something that has an enormous impact on her ability to train and manage her training. And I do just think, you know, that's what I think of when I imagine her playing her final year on the circuit. She's at kind of 8 on the countdown to 0, holding that plank. And look, everyone knows how much I love Danielle Collins, but I have loved seeing her do this week. And I know, Matt, you bristle at people trying to push backhand listers on you. So I won't. I'll try not to be too pushy, but I would just say that if she's ever going to make an appearance on the backhand list, it has to be this year, right? And, you know she won't be on it for long. She'll make space, she'll make way for somebody else in a few months' time. I just urge you to consider her this
only
one
five
last
spots.
Time.
Well, look, she has been on the wait list, the watch list for a little while. You know, I've always had my eye on her backhand. I guess I should say that perhaps there could be a little, in the same way that the WTA Tour has sort of upgraded to have a bit of a maternity rule, perhaps my backhand list could have a maternity rule, because Belinda Bencic is currently out, so maybe she could be temporarily replaced by Danielle Collins. I think what has perhaps held me back in the past is that it's all out attack, kind of it's all out.
That's
Collins
the best
backhand
thing about
which
it,
I
Matt.
Love about it. I love
she's
about
intensity
it.
List and backhand list at the same time.
If you think of the backhands on my list, they tend to be a bit more sort of smooth power, and that is that is
Matt's
really
such a
what
cerebral
gets me going.
Backhand guy.
But absolutely considering it, and I should sort of flip this on you, Catherine, because you know we can talk about things that I've said in the past in terms of backhand list. You called a very vague prediction, but a good one, of Danielle Collins doing, I think it was something big this year.
And it was something big in a big tournament.
Right. And look, I
yes,
think this
Catherine.
Counts. I think reaching the Miami final in the manner she has absolutely counts. And I think I've often thought that Collins is dangerous in tournaments. You know, she can beat big players, but I never really have the belief that she's actually going to end up lifting the trophy. She's only won 2 titles in her entire career, and she's had a great career, but they've been at 250 level, 500 level. She tends to either run into someone playing better, or I think there are little gaps in her game. Like, I do think her second serve is pretty vulnerable, and I think that's going to be an interesting part of the final, you know, her second serve against Rybakina's return. But so far she's just been on the gas the whole time this tournament, and it's been great to see. And there's also again, Catherine, another subplot that you'll enjoy, which is of course the Olympics. I believe it's 4 players per nation, isn't it, who can represent at the Olympics, and she's currently the 5th ranked American woman, and a title here would go a long way to helping her overtake, I think, Navarro and Keys are sort of the ones in her sights, and I think that race runs through to the end of Roland Garros, so there's still a lot of points and things to play for. But you know, I don't know how Danielle Collins feels about the Olympics, but if it's a big motivator for her final year on tour, then you know, this would certainly be going a long way to helping her get in that Olympic setup for the States.
Yeah, I'd love to ask her about that. I rather suspect, knowing what we do about Danielle Collins, it would be a massive motivator. I mean, she's a stalwart of the Billie Jean King Cup team, isn't she? I know she's had that incredibly close relationship with Cathy Rinaldi, the former captain, over the years. But it would astonish me if an Olympics, particularly one on clay at Roland Garros, where she's played so well over the years, it would astonish me if that wasn't a big goal of hers. Nobody is probably more displeased at the Emma Navarro being so unexpectedly good in 2024. She probably had the same reaction as Matt to realising that Emma Navarro is suddenly seeded at Grand Slams. Did you know Emma Navarro is seeded at a Grand Slam? I think she's top 20 now, Emma Navarro. Anyway, should we talk a little bit about Iga Świątek's loss to Ekaterina Alexandra? Do we have anything to say? Is it just one of those things? I mean, Alexandra, one of those big, clean, smooth hitters that when she's on and in the zone can traditionally trouble Iga Świątek?
Yeah, I think my take here is that it reminded me of the Australian Open, in that at the Australian Open, Świątek beat Collins, didn't she, in a match against a big hitter. And we all thought, oh, that's a massive deal for Świątek to come through one of those matches. And she had another one in the next round in Noskova and she lost it. And here she had a big hitter in Noskova. She came through it, didn't have her best tennis, but we thought, OK, that's a big moment. And then she loses to a big hitter in the next round. And I think what I'm starting to realise with Świątek is that I know she can elevate in finals and find a different level in finals. She's proven that, how good her record is. But it does strike me that she maybe struggles to improve her tennis all that much during the course of a tournament. I feel like you get a sense quite early in a tournament whether Świątek's playing well or not. You know, like at Indian Wells, she was just laying down those dominant score lines straight away, and it was like, oh, okay, this is kind of peak Świątek, and it carried through the entire tournament. She's there are countless examples of that in her career where she's just been sort of thrashing people all the way through. There are a couple of examples now where she's really battled and you think that's going to be a massive moment, but then she's kind of still in that form in the next round and ends up losing. And it's impressive that she wins those matches, but maybe that's another step to take for Iga Świątek, like coming through a tough match and then improving your level after that. I feel like maybe she just didn't quite do that in Miami. And I don't think it's a massive deal. I mean, I think her start to the season has been better than last year's start to the season. You know, last year she only won the one title before the clay. This year she's won two, and they've both been 1,000 events. Like, she's had a good start to the season in that sense. So I don't read too much into it, but that's just, I don't know, it's just as we're learning more and more about these players, that's just a little pattern that I've started to pick up on with Świątek. It feels like she's either in tournament-winning dominant form or it's a little bit more of a struggle and she never quite finds that form. And there have been examples of her winning tournaments without peak form. I mean, I don't think she ever really played her best at the US Open that she won, and that was incredibly impressive. But, you know, there are developments still, even as the world number one, that she can make, and this maybe feels like one of them. But credit to Alexandra, because she did play a smarter match against Świątek than she did against Collins. Certainly she was adjusting her return position, she was hitting down the line extremely well. It was a really good performance from her, and Świątek just wasn't quite able to live with it.
So no sunshine double for Iga Świątek, no sunshine double for either the men or the women this year, because of course Carlos Alcaraz lost last night to Grigor Dimitrov. Just before we move on to talk about the men's event, somebody would like to talk about the Hawkeye outage that delayed the Azarenka-Putintseva match. Who would like the floor for that?
Well, I was asleep, so I'll give it to Matt.
Well, you didn't miss anything. It was just 45.
It's Matt that's put it in the agenda. So
it was just 45 minutes of waiting around. And look, I do think it's something that, as we move into this era of relying on the technology for line calls, which generally I am in favour of, absolutely, there's no backup, and that's a bit of an issue. And I remember it happened at Indian Wells last year. It's happened this year in Miami, and it's just something that I think tennis needs to think about. Like, it needs maybe a set of line judges on standby. Look, I don't know how practical
is. They were bussing in line judges in Indian Wells last year from some sort of junior tournament down the road or something.
Yeah, like, can you just have line judges on standby? I don't know, but it does seem that you know, this is a big match, TV. It's just a bit of a farce if we're waiting around 45 minutes, an hour for the technology. And yeah, it just wasn't a good look. Putin Tsaiva was not happy.
I mean, obviously, the answer there is let Azarenka and Putin Tsaiva call their own lines.
Because, would watch.
Yeah. As a reward for the people that have waited around 45 minutes. Okay, on to the men's event. And let's start with Grigor Dimitrov against Carlos Alcaraz. 2-set victory for Dimitrov through to the semifinals, where he'll face Alexander Zverev. I know that everybody listening to this that's ever listened to a tennis podcast before is going to take everything we say about Grigor Dimitrov with a pinch of salt. And rightly so. We cannot be trusted to be objective about Grigor Dimitrov. But please believe me, please, I implore you to believe me when I tell you he was unplayable last night against Carlos Alcaraz. That's not to say that Alcaraz didn't do anything wrong. I think he actually thought Alcaraz came out playing really well and was pretty stunned by what was coming back at him and got a bit rocked by that. The second set, barring a sort of a little moment of magic where he breaks back to love in the middle of the set. Second set, a bit ropier from Alcaraz. But Alcaraz just was not the story of this match. I was astonished at the level of Grigor Dimitrov. I'm afraid if you hug the baseline, I mean, he didn't let himself get pushed back an inch from that baseline. If you're half volleying off both wings at 80 ground strokes at 80 miles per hour and moving like a gazelle and hitting inches from the line, is pretty much unplayable. And that is what Grigor Dimitrov did for 2 sets last night. He was awesome, Matt.
He was. And I know he's been compared to Federer his whole career. And that baby Fed tag was probably, you know, it weighed on him for a while and probably wasn't helpful. But I texted the WhatsApp group during this and said, this match is making me yearn for Federer Alcaraz that we never got to see, because that was the most like Federer that I've seen Dimitrov play, I think possibly ever. And certainly latter day Federer, when he started, you know, standing up on the baseline and ripping his backhands and taking everything early. It just reminded me of that. He was absolutely incredible. He came out with an intent to dominate Alcaraz, to take Alcaraz's time away by standing in on returns. And he was still doing some of his good stuff in terms of using his slice backhand at times and coming forward. And, you know, there were typical Dimitrov aspects in there as well. But there was just an intent and an aggression, and he was out forehanding Alcaraz. Like, all of it was unbelievably good. And I agree with you. I think Alcaraz's level dropping was a direct result of being stunned and shocked by what Dimitrov was producing. Sometimes it's hard to know why a player's game has gone off suddenly, but it felt pretty obvious. It felt like Alcaraz was just like, whoa, I wasn't expecting this. And in his press conference afterwards, Alcaraz gave a great line saying that Grigor Dimitrov made me feel like I was 13. And honestly, I saw Alcaraz when he was 13. He was fucking good, even at 13. So, like, that isn't dissing Dimitrov. Like, it was just amazing what he was doing. Absolutely brilliant. And I think the whole time we were like, this can't keep up. He can't last. It's going to drop. And bar, like, maybe one game, but that was mostly Alcaraz just suddenly peaking and zoning, it didn't. And he kept it up, and he was absolutely sensational.
The thing is, David, with Grigor, you just never know.
And he's been looking dangerous for a while. I mean, you know,
you might say for sort of 15 years.
You're right. I read a quote from Danny Valverde, one of his two coaches with Jamie Delgado, in Chris Clary's Substack that he writes from time to time. And Chris is there, I believe, and had a chat with Danny. And Danny said, you know, this is the sort of thing that can happen when you've been doing the right things for a while. Mm. And there's no question that Dimitrov has been more professional and more diligent and disciplined in his tennis in the last 12 months than he's ever been, in my opinion. He's had better results than he's having right now. He's yet to have his semi-finals at Grand Slams and win an ATP Finals, but then everybody else has got better and Grigor's got a bit older. So, you know, there are probably some limits to how far it can take him. But I don't think he's ever just packaged his game week in, week out like this. And then this was, to use those words again, a peaking, zoning Dimitrov within the framework of that disciplined approach. And I think he came out knowing that he had to do this. He couldn't play his normal game and it work against this guy. He had to rattle him somehow, and he rattled him by playing Federer-like tennis. And I'm sure Federer's best tennis, when he was playing that aggressive style, would probably have given Alcaraz some horrible duffings until Alcaraz figured something out as a way to counteract it. And I'm sure he would have done, because I think he's good enough. But I do think that Alcaraz's decision to move to the back of the court to return serve the way he has the last couple of weeks, which has really paid dividends against lots of opponents. It's given him more time. It's stopped him probably shanking and getting out of rhythm the way he had been in the last 6 months or so. Against Dimitrov, he was made to pay, because that was not assertive tennis, and it was ceding the ground to an opponent who was quite happy to say, okay, I'm taking this on. I don't care if it doesn't work. This is me today. And frankly, it bothered Alcaraz.
Did it worry you, David, that he didn't adjust that, Alcaraz? He never even
took him too long.
Tried step. Yeah, until kind
only
of the very
the second
end.
Set, only that panic. He's 6-2, 4-1 down. And then it's like he just thought, well, this isn't working. I'm going to go turbo. You know, and suddenly he stands on the baseline and rips 99-mile-an-hour forehands for clean winners four times in a row. It was kind of a bit like how that match against Zverev unfolded. Okay, he didn't come out in the same rattled, strange look in his eye that he had against Zverev that day, but Zverev rocked him that night and got him on the back foot and went for broke because he knew he had to. And it was only when Alcaraz produced those moments of magic to win the third set that he came alive. You're asking for a heck of a Houdini act at that point, aren't you, when you're that far down to keep that going? And so I do think, Catherine, I do think that he got into his mind, this is my tactic, this is how I've been told to play, and he's too far down before he does anything about it. I do think Alcaraz is still tactically a real work in progress. I think when he's feeling it, there's no better sight in the sport. But he's too reliant, I think. I mean, you know, I know some people will say, well, doesn't matter, does it? Ferreira's there all the time, most of the time anyway. He's not going to have knee operations very often. I just think part of being a tennis player is knowing what to do in the moment and being able to adjust.
Yeah, and I think he's brilliant at that purely for himself. Like his tennis instincts are exceptional, I think. His feel for the game and shot selection. What I think he lacks is the adjustment to what's happening down the other end of the court. It's kind of too selfish an approach to the sport, I suppose. Matt, what do you think?
I think that's spot on, yeah. And I think there's an interesting sort of wider, big picture tennis sort of maybe generational question here in terms of, you know, Alcaraz has grown up in an era where he's allowed to have his coach tell him what to do during matches. And I think that was often one of the points that people would have against allowing on-court coaching. We don't want to create tennis players that need someone else to tell them what to do. We want tennis players who can sort of figure stuff out on their own. And I think maybe it's just going to take Alcaraz that little bit longer. Maybe it's something that, you know, players of Nadal and Murray and Djokovic's generation they grew up having to figure these things out on their own when they're out on court. And of course, there was always looking to coaching going on. That's part of the reason why coaching has come in, because it was happening anyway. But there was less reliance on it. I think there's more reliance on it now. And yeah, I think it's important that Alcaraz figures it out himself and has sort of Juan Carlos Ferrer there as a backup. Because, I mean, you saw last night, he was literally having a sort of dialogue with Juan Carlos Ferrero from a sort of, he was sitting in his chair and Alcaraz was in, and Ferrero was in the stands, and he was saying, do I go forward? Do I go back? I don't know what to do. He was confused about what to do to sort of counter Dimitrov's brilliance. And I think if he can get to a place where he's able to realize these things earlier in matches, that will definitely help him. But just on a Dimitrov perspective, I ended up quite pleased, because I've always thought that, like, maybe the best match I've ever seen Dimitrov play, he lost, which was that Australian Open semi-final against Rafael Nadal, where I really think he was extraordinary in that match. He was just up against, you know, an all-time great. And in a way, that's always felt a bit cruel, but maybe also a bit fitting. But actually, I'm not sure I've seen Dimitrov play better than he did last night. And it's nice that he then, you know, played a performance like that and got a win as well. And yeah, I was pleased for Grigor, I have to say.
Same. And I feel the same about that performance pretty much as well as I can remember him playing. And yes, I think he's going to lose to Alexander Zverev. Because matchups are everything, and confidence is everything, particularly for Grigor Dimitrov. And I think it was massive for Dimitrov in the match against Alcaraz in terms of his, you know, that style of play, that full throttle, requires a total conviction in what you're doing. And I think the fact that Dimitrov had beaten him only a few months ago, that enabled him to believe in what he was doing. And I think as much as he's going to be telling himself that he can do something similar against Zverev, I think he's got a mental gremlin there against Zverev that he actually doesn't have against Alcaraz, and he certainly doesn't have now. And it's also, you know, tennis wise a completely different matchup for him. What do you think, David?
Well, I think one of the best periods of a match that I'd ever seen Dimitrov play was against Zverev at the US Open last year. Then he just started to struggle under the weight of shot and the weight of keeping it going. And you could see how one guy had got it within him to just keep on doing this for as long as he needed to. And the other guy, Dimitrov, was having to redline it all the way, all the time, just to keep that little bit ahead. And to do it over best of five sets, that's so difficult. And if you look at that head-to-head, he's won all of the last, whatever, six or seven in a row. And I think maybe best of three gives him a slightly better chance, but he would have to bring that level. He'd have to bring last night's level, I think, because Zverev is in that really easy-going power kind of form at the moment. I saw his win over Felix Auger-Aliassime in the first match that he played, and I mean, Felix is, you know, okay, he may not be what we thought he was going to be, but he's still a good player and he's a great athlete. Couldn't get anywhere near Zverev in that match. And then he's gone and beaten Fabian Marajan last night, who's had a great week. And he's just beating people quite easily, is Zverev. So I'd be surprised if he came out and didn't play well. And that therefore requires Dimitrov to play out of his mind. But you just never know. You just never, I mean, I'm serious. I still, it's still possible.
I mean, anything's possible.
From Grigor, yeah. Do you know, Catherine, it is very nearly 11 years to the day when we headlined an edition of the Tennis Podcast called Is This It for Grigor?
What had he just done to make us think that?
He'd just beaten Novak Djokovic in Madrid.
Yeah.
It wasn't it.
But what counts as it now? For us to headline a podcast with those words again, what would we have to think he might be on the brink of? Winning Miami. Oh,
Winning Miami would be a big deal, but honestly, it would be reaching the final of a Grand Slam tournament, because that would be something he's never done before.
Okay,
but to me, these are
a ways to go before it might.
The question I want to ask Dimitrov when we get to see him again is, what happened in that match in the Australian Open against Borges? I'd love to know what happened that day, because you know that was right there for him, and he couldn't find it, and that's the only real duffer of a performance he's put in all last year. I'm assuming it was a terrible performance, and that sounds really harsh to the Portuguese player who played brilliantly. But still, I don't care. You should still win if you're Dimitrov.
Yeah, especially from... He was in a position of controlling that match, wasn't he? And he let it slip away from him. Okay, so Dimitrov Zverev is one semi-final. The other semi-final on the men's side is a replay of the Australian Open final and of last year's Miami final. Daniil Medvedev against Jannik Sinner. It's the match you wanted, Matt. It's the match you're getting.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, was Miami last year the last time Medvedev beat Sinner, I think? It's all been in Sinner's favour since then. I think I sound like a broken record, but I think you can trace Medvedev's head-to-head against Sinner and the way it's turned in Sinner's favour, with obviously Sinner becoming a better player and in his post-puke era, but also Medvedev's serve deteriorating. And I think the serve is massive for Medvedev against Sinner, and I was encouraged by the way Medvedev served against Nicolas Jarry. I think that's the best I've seen him serve for a little while. Especially in that tiebreak, he found all the first serves. It was just good, encouraging signs from Medvedev, and he's going to need that. And I think it's interesting because in Melbourne, Medvedev adopted this incredibly aggressive approach, didn't he, in those first two sets against Sinner, which was largely out of necessity because he was feeling so tired. But it really worked, and it's going to be interesting whether he comes out playing like that again against Sinner tonight. If he does, he'll lose that element of surprise, because I don't think Sinner was expecting it in Melbourne, and I think he'll be a bit more wise to it this time. I don't think Sinner's been quite playing his best tennis. I thought he was very good at times against Thomas Mahac. He was just sort of too relentless for him, but generally he's been in kind of doing enough mode to get by players this week, and that's an impressive sort of string to your bow anyway that Sinner's developed. But I think Medvedev, he needs a win. He needs to get a big win over an Alcaraz or a Sinner or a Djokovic. And this feels like as good a time as any. You know, he's not expended too much energy. He's playing better. We know he likes Miami, so he's obviously won it before, although that perhaps works against him because he never wins the same tournament twice. But I think everything's sort of set for Medvedev for maybe this to be the one where he can finally do it. And if he doesn't, it's beginning to think, well, when is he going to beat these guys? I think this is a pretty big match for Daniil Medvedev tonight.
I agree. I think it's a massive match for Medvedev. The risk of just repeating everything you've just said, he needs to beat one of Alcaraz and Sinner. And actually, I think beating Sinner would be more significant because he used to be his pigeon, Sinner. He used to be somebody that he just walked onto court knowing he had his number. And that's exactly how I felt only 12 months ago watching that final from courtside. I just thought these games don't match up. I just thought Medvedev's going to have to be way off for Sinner to ever beat him. And that has just turned completely on its head. And now I don't think it's a matchup problem either way. I just think Sinner's top level is higher than Medvedev's. But as you say, Matt, I don't think this is the Sinner that Medvedev ran into at the Australian Open. I think this is a massive opportunity for Medvedev to get a much needed win, and I'm fascinated by that semi-final.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
We have news. We have a couple of bits of quite big news from the last few days. Just before I tell you about that, should we just have a little barge moment, David? Because we've launched the barge, haven't we? It's been quite a big week for us and for friends of the Tennis Podcast. We have set sail and it's been pretty frantic, but it's been pretty fun as well.
Wonderful, really. To see quite so many people, hundreds and hundreds of people, coming onto this platform that we've created. We've called it the Barge, and we've not really known what to expect. I mean, we've tried our very best to preempt issues and set it up as best as we possibly can, and we've said all along, you know, it is a work in progress. This is a very new platform for us, and the people that are putting it on have not done it before either, and as we've gone along, we're like, oh, we didn't think of this, we didn't think of that, but we're really trying to make it the best we can, and we're noting all the feedback down. But honestly, just seeing these hundreds of people come together and just have conversations about tennis and ideas and thoughts and sharing memories and their love for the sports in a really convivial way, like you would on the barge, like you would in a pub when you're having a drink, when you're not being horrible to each other like people are on social media so often. I mean, it's exactly what we wanted this to be all along, and I'm chuffed to bits that it's started, and thank you so much for so many of you taking part and seemingly enjoying it, and yeah, there's room for many more if you want to come.
Yes, Matt has been diligently replying to everybody that has said their tennis walk on music would be a Bruce Springsteen song, which is a lot of you.
It's exactly the crossover that I was hoping for to find on the barge, you know, some Bruce Springsteen tennis fans. Yeah, I've been chatting about people's trips to see Bruce Springsteen and the shows they're going to in the future. I'm basically doing a control F on the barge Springsteen and just replying to all those people. It's great.
Yeah, it's it is great. It is. And thank you to everybody that's got involved so far. And to everybody that's thinking of getting involved and wants to give it a try, please, please come along. And if you'd like to become a friend of the Tennis Podcast and get access to the Barge, to our 24 additional episodes that we record year-round exclusively for friends of the Tennis Podcast, to all sorts of other things as well. Hannah's column, there's going to be another one of those coming soon. We do a bunch of extra live YouTube shows, one a month for friends of the Tennis Podcast. There's so much stuff we're doing for you. And the link to join the party is in our show notes. Now, news. We talked about Andy Murray's final, probably, match on a hard court on Monday's show and the ankle injury, the ankle turn that he seemed to sustain towards the end of that. He finished the match in a deciding set tiebreak, losing it to Thomas Mahac. We didn't know at the time the nature of the ankle injury. Well, he confirmed on social media on Tuesday that it is a full rupture of his anterior talofibular ligament and near full thickness rupture of his calcaneofibular ligament. He said it's a tough one to take and that he'll be out for, quote, an extended period. He added, I'll be back with one hip and no ankle ligaments when the time is right. And we've had confirmation today from his agent that he's out of Monte Carlo and Munich for sure, which was kind of the ultimate non-announcement when it landed in the inbox, because you don't hear ligament rupture and think, oh, maybe he'll be back for Monte Carlo in a couple of weeks. You know, I saw those many medical words and thought, well, we might never see Andy Murray play tennis again. Rupture is a very, very bad word. And extended period is a bad word when it kind of didn't feel like he had an extended period left in his career anyway. I do think Andy Murray will do absolutely whatever it takes just to be able to step out onto a tennis court again, even if it's just to have some kind of goodbye on his own terms. But this is worse than we feared. And the fact is, devastating as it is to say, this could kind of be it, David.
Yeah, I did not think he was in this situation when he managed to finish the match and actually play really well and nearly turn it around and win the other night. And it just goes to show you don't know what's going on in your body. And it's impossible for a physio to diagnose that on courtside. It's impossible for people like us to be able to tell for sure when we're watching on TV. And that sounds bad. I mean, there's no other way to say it. I think the sensible course of action most likely would be to just shelve everything until grass and try to play that challenger again in Nottingham and then try to play Queens and then try to play Wimbledon. And look, he's pretty much been saying that this is it for after this summer. And so maybe this crystallizes it more in his mind if that is the case. And if he is able to at least get out there and play the sort of tennis he wants to play on grass again. But I think that's, yes, with this news, that's probably quite optimistic for this year.
Mm. 6 weeks, the internet says, for a ligament rupture. So, I mean, that's six weeks before he can get back in training. So even grass, I think, is, you know, touch and go. But if anyone can, Andy Murray can, so fingers crossed for him. The other big bit of news that we had this week was that Novak Djokovic and Goran Ivanišević have ended their partnership after 5 very successful years together. Djokovic wrote, I remember clearly the moment I invited Goran to be part of my team. It was back in 2018, and Marion, that's Vida, and I were looking to innovate and bring some serve magic to our duo. In fact, not only we brought serve, but also lots of laughter, fun, year-end number one rankings, record-breaking achievements, and 12 more Grand Slams and a few finals to the count since then. Did I mention a bit of drama too? Our on-court chemistry had its ups and downs, but our friendship was always rock solid. And Djokovic told the Serbian journalist Sasha Osmo, I still don't have a clear idea who a new coach would be or whether there will be one at all. I've had coaches since I was a kid. Now I'm trying to feel by myself what I need, what I feel most comfortable with. This was a surprise. This to me was a big surprise. David, what was your reaction?
Very surprised. That is a huge run of success that those two have had together. My mind went back to, I think, an interview you did with Goran Kathryn in Paris when he was working with Andre Agassi. You're going back 6 or 7 years now. And Goran's surprise at that announcement and the fact that you could clearly tell he would love the job and he would love to have a go at it and believe that he'd be a better fit for Djokovic. And my word, were they a good fit. You know, he's won half of his Grand Slam title haul in 5 years with Goran Ivanišević by his side. And look, it's not all Goran's doing at all, but there is a massive uptick in the speed of his serve since they started working together. There's a security in that serve. It just sort of made him race through games. I mean, that is not the player that was winning Grand Slam titles 10, 15 years ago. And also, I just think their personalities, yes, there was friction when he was courtside. To me, that was necessary. That was helpful. The fact that Goran's prepared to stand up to him and give him somebody to bounce off and all that sort of thing. Now, Djokovic is so experienced now, and is frankly, it doesn't really matter if he wins anymore or not. But he has overhauled his entire team of people in the last year. Agent, spokesperson, people he'd been with a long, long time, management company, and now his most trusted coach. And also, if you go back a bit further, Marin Vida also left as well. So that leaves him with nobody really from his core team. And maybe this is just what he needs, a shake-up. Maybe the Sinner loss makes him need a shake-up. Who knows? But I think it does raise big question marks over the next steps, and we'll find out. I mean, he's always been able to come back for more and win again, but I'm not entirely convinced that this is a great situation for him to be in.
David has been flirting with Goran Ivanišević on WhatsApp to try and coax him into talking to us. Not that we think that there's any, we've got no reason to think that there's any big story or revelation besides what each of them have said, but still, we're working on it, folks. Or more specifically,
Goran's only response at the moment,
David is working on it.
Is there's nothing to worry about? I mean, he hasn't actually said anything publicly, but he has said, "Look, nothing happened." You know, I don't want to talk to you because nothing happened.
Yes, we Matt and I got to hear a voice note that Goran sent David, which said nothing happened, and David, I love you, all of one message, or rather, Eagle, I love you, which is what Goran calls David.
Yes,
for reasons that I think have been disclosed on past podcasts, but we don't have the time to go into now, but are excellent.
Yeah, there's been some West Brom chat flying around as well. All the David Goran hits.
David's pulling all the levers, folks, to get you the story. So watch this space next week.
It's quite interesting. I remember when he lost to Sinner at the Australian Open, we sort of had a conversation in terms of, we don't really know what this result means in the moment. You know, we need to go 6-12 months down the line, and maybe we will look back at this result as sort of pivotal in the beginning of the end of Novak Djokovic, or maybe not. Maybe it's just a blip and he goes on to win so many more Grand Slam tournaments. Who knows? We still don't really know. But I do remember that everything felt a bit flat that day for Novak Djokovic, even between him and his team. I mean, David spoke there about that on-court friction that he always had with Goran Ivanišević, and how from the outside that looked a little bit, oh, okay, there's a lot going on in that box. But that was a really helpful thing, I think, for Djokovic. It fired him up in so many matches when he was down. He would turn to his box and get inspired and sort of become an alpha on the court. And it never really happened in that semi-final at the Australian Open. There was sort of nothing coming from the box. There was not much from Djokovic to the box. And look, I don't know, but sort of looking back now, it does strike me that I was totally shocked as well by this. I'm not saying that I called this in any way, but just looking back in hindsight, I do think that there was a different energy in that box at the Australian Open than there had been in kind of previous tournaments. And maybe it's just, you know, after 5 years, and I think it's, I mean, Goran's alluded to it in the past, hasn't he, that sometimes he will be on the eve of a Grand Slam tournament with Novak Djokovic, and suddenly Djokovic has got an idea about the fact that, oh no, we need to be working on backhands. And suddenly it's like, wow, it's a lot working in that Novak Djokovic camp. And they've also been through, you know, the last 5 years for Novak Djokovic have been incredibly successful on the court, but also some of the most turbulent years of his life, really, when you think about the disqualification at the US Open and being deported from Australia, like things that, you know, were largely his own doing. But he got caught up in all that. And Goran was sat in a detention centre in Australia on Novak Djokovic's behalf. Like, there's been a lot in the last 5 years. And maybe it's just sort of run its course rather than any one big sort of moment of friction. I don't know, but it makes the Novak Djokovic next few months, which were fascinating anyway with the juggling act of the Olympics and his pursuit for more Grand Slams, even more fascinating, I think.
Yeah, fascinating period of Djokovic's career and Goran's. Is he going to get snapped up? Mm. Has Holger Rune already called him? These are all questions that we're hoping David has the opportunity to ask him next week. So watch this space, folks. Monday's show after the Miami finals will be live on YouTube for all listeners that fancy joining us live and seeing our faces. That'll be at 8 o'clock UK time on Monday, which is 3 o'clock East Coast time in the US and midday West Coast time in the US, and at various different times of the morning in Australia. I do know that there are other time zones, but I don't think it would make good radio if I went through every time zone. Hopefully you can you can fill in the blanks there. But we will be back on Monday with a live show on YouTube to wrap up all things Miami. If you want to not join us live, not see our faces, then you can just listen to it as a podcast as usual. We have a mascot for this episode. That mascot is Stray, owned by Carol Ray, who we know and is absolutely lovely. Matt, you met Carol at the Wimbledon History Conference, is that right?
That is right, yes.
I remember the photo you got with her. Yes. Matt Roberts' words, not mine, ladies and gentlemen. Stray is a returning mascot, and it's a good job Stray is a returning mascot, because it means I have already seen a photo of Stray, because I'm pointing no fingers about ball dropping here, but it says insert photo where there should be a picture of a lovely dog. Would anybody like to explain themselves?
That is entirely my fault. But yes, Stray's already featured in our newsletter this week, yes. So you've seen Stray.
And they're all on the barge, Stray. And Catherine's just sort of, you know, there's a thread. The second thread is introduce your pet, and Catherine is just spending hours per day on that particular
topic.
It's
like an animal catalogue. It's brilliant. So good. Stray is a four-year-old English pointer who was rescued in 2020 from Spain, where she was found on the streets with her mother. She's gone from being scared of everything to confident and very funny. God, those sorts of stories make me cry. She loves tennis balls hit down the garden with a racket, but she won't bring them back. She's a bundle of energy, very cuddly, and has two modes, running or sleeping. So, yeah, Stray has already been in this week's newsletter. I'm going to pop a picture of her on Instagram as well. So, hello, Stray, and thank you, Carol. We have our mascots. I have the dearly departed Darwin. We're still in the game with Yannick Sinner. So we'll see how that goes. David has Francis and Matt has Haider and Soma. Are hopes alive for Francis, Haider and Soma?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Not for Haider and Soma. No, out of the game.
I've lost all three of mine. Świątek, Alcaraz and now Azarenka in my backup. I haven't even got my backup in.
Well, I had a Caroline Garcia moment, David, so it's tough,
Daniel
tough
Collins
situation.
Does not forgive you.
No, I should have picked Daniel Collins, shouldn't I? Anyway, hindsight's wonderful.
We all should have picked Daniel Collins.
Billie Jean is currently asleep on three separate pieces of our recording tech. So fingers crossed you're hearing this right now. She is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss, who've been at the Dodgers opening game of the season this week. There has been much very heartwarming content coming out of Team Billie Jean King. We have our top folks and executive producers, Greg, Chris, Jeff and Jamie. And we have shout outs. Over to you, Matt.
We start with Dana Douglas, who is, of course, from New Jersey.
What a name, Dana. It is. What a contingent we have.
We're like one in three or four shout outs feel like they're
right.
From New Jersey.
Do you think people are just lying at this point and saying they're from New Jersey when they're not? Just to be part of the gang. To be fair, Dana Douglas sounds like a New Jersey name.
There
it's
was,
a great name.
I believe it may not be this Dana, or it may be. We've had a Dana before, and I thought of a chair umpire that used to be very well known and got a good old telling off from Jimmy Connors in the 1991 run. And his name was Dana LeConto. So there we are.
Wow.
Wow. Do we have any tennis Douglases?
I was going to say, just another one for Dana is the wheelchair player, Dana Matthewson, who
Ooh, very
won
good.
Wimbledon, I think, maybe a couple of years ago.
I was going to go Doug Spreen, the former ATP trainer that went to work for Andy Roddick.
Correct.
Like
yeah.
It.
Thank you, Dana.
We've also got Debbie Goldstein.
Hi, Debbie.
Hello, Debbie. We know Debbie, I think.
Yes, yep. Debbie shares David's passion for Pete Sampras.
Yes, Debbie.
Passion for Pete Sampras aren't words that are often together. Unless you're speaking to Debbie or David.
One of the questions in the introduce yourself thread was which shot would you have for a day from any player? And I went for the running forehand cross court from Pete Sampras in the 90s, obviously. Debbie would have gone for the same, I dare say. I'll have to look it up.
I think Pete Sampras's serve would serve you better, but yeah. Well, you've already got quite a good forehand.
That's true.
Don't know how it is on the run. I've never seen it on the run, but let's assume
Matt's seen
it's
it.
Just
pretty
good
actually.
Yeah,
David can get it in a sort of postage stamp of you know, between sideline and baseline.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he's got to be a winner. Check, I think, because I think once David's committed to hitting that forehand on the run, he's unlikely to make it back into the court, but it often is a winner.
Thank you, Debbie. Tennis Debbies.
Deborah Jevons.
Yes.
Oh, very
good. Very
good.
Oof, at the 11th hour. Thank you, Debbie.
She's the new chairperson of Wimbledon.
And finally, we've got Claire Bourne, who is giving a shout-out for her mum, Anne Bourne.
Oh, love
lovely.
That.
Claire says, this shout-out is a Christmas present for my mum. We moved around a lot when I was younger, South Africa, Japan, the States, but watching and playing tennis was a constant. And due to our shared love of the pod, we always have some fun tennis-related content to talk about. I thought that was
lovely.
That's absolutely lovely. How is Anne spelled?
Anne is A-double-N-E.
Ah, same church, different pew.
Yeah.
Like Anne Kiosavon.
My middle name is Anne with no E. But Anne Kiosavon does have an E. Very good. And Claire, we always say Claire Wood, don't we?
I was going to say Claire Wood
Liu. Gets a lot of airtime. And Claire Liu. Claire, Anne, thank you. That's a very heartwarming story to end on. Thank you to all of our friends of the Tennis Podcast. See you on the barge. See everybody on Monday for our live show, 8 p.m. UK time, or just on the pod as usual. Only a couple of days to wait. Lots of fun in Miami. Happy Easter to those that celebrate. We will see you on Monday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.